I'm Kathy Bosch, and this is a session on parent and teen concerns, some questions and possibilities. And I have about five, six, seven questions that came out of the parent box. I have a nice list that came out of the teen group, the minors. Some concerns that they listed, working in small groups and taking a sheet of paper and writing down some of the concerns, going from the ridiculous to the sublime, and a lot of important things in between. Let me give you an idea of what some, now remember I said there were 30 teens in this group, what some of the teens listed as concerns. I think very concerned of what would other teens think if they listed that or if they suggested that to their small group. So it was pretty risky for those who even put these down. Issue of curfew, house, I bet you can guess 90% of these. Curfew, housework, allowance, grades, parties, phone time, friends. Then there come some additional ones. Questions about sex, parents who think we're inferior, parents who don't respect my privacy, overprotectiveness, false IDs. I didn't quite get the specifics as to whether they wanted them from parents or whether they wanted to tell parents about them. Role models, parents as role models. Skipping school, clothing and hair, life, death, foreign affairs, space program, Star Wars, defense spending, forcing us to do things against our will. Now, let me list some of the questions from the parents that I think are very basic and very good. Three of them dealing with the issue of sex. One about dealing with anger, one about communication lines, one about building self-esteem, how to keep up to date as parents on what teens are experiencing, such as drugs, alcohol, peer pressure, competition, depression. Those are all very important when you realize, depending upon what was the latest survey that you look at, that the number one or number two top cause of death for teens is either accidents or suicide. And you wonder how many of the accidents are really suicides. So depression and that whole area are really very important issues to deal with. Why are teens at times so extremely rude or horrible, hostile to parents, and how should parents react? What do teens want from their parents in terms of discussions about sex? Up to now, teens, at least the majority, have been much more casual with sex than the older generation. Do you think this will change with the fear of herpes, AIDS, etc.? And one of the biggest, if not the, I'm not sure if this came from a parent or a teen. Sounds like it could be from either. One of the biggest, if not the biggest, question facing teens is how to deal with their sexuality. Where can they turn for answers about how to relate to those of the opposite sex as well as those of the same sex? And where can they go if they think they may be homosexual? Now, I forget what one of the schedules on the board that I had offered to do this week, whether it's tomorrow or Wednesday, I forget. Is on what should we tell the kids about sexuality and AIDS. So we'll deal with some of that tonight too, because that is an important issue. The whole issue of sex, the whole issue of the sexually transmitted diseases, especially AIDS, the whole concern about homosexuality. What is it? Am I one? Might my child be one? Am I doing something that may make my child one? Some real concerns. Where do we start? Should we deal with the issues, the individual issues first, or the issues on sexuality? Do you have some additional ones to add? think in many ways there's some relationship among them all. And one is looking at how do we view adolescence. Adolescence is a new word coined, what, 25, 30 years ago. I mean, we didn't, 14-year-old, 15-year-olds were adults back in the earlier generations. The U.S. was charted and settled by a lot of young people who barely passed their 20th birthday. They were the energetic ones. They were the ones who had the strength and the adventure to come on over. A lot of them may have been married at age 20 back, 50, 60, 70, in their teens, back in those earlier days or beginning of the century. And now we try to keep our teens, adolescents, at a much longer time until they finish university or college or really get settled in some job. And it's really a very difficult thing, knowing when to let go. We're not at that point. Let's look at where we're beginning, where we are right now, whether we're beginning or whether we're in the midst of it, to look at what has been the relationship up to this point. I should say our daughters now are 22 and 25. We've passed through the teenage years, with the grace of God, I'm sure, without major generation gaps. There were times I would need to say, particularly to our second daughter, as we'd pass each other sometime after a couple of days, past the kitchen sink or something such as this, hey, wait a minute, I'm losing touch. I'm beginning to think we don't know who each other is. Let's find some time to talk. It may have even gotten to a point at one time where my daughter was afraid to ride in the car with me, our second daughter particularly, because I would turn the radio off and I'd say, let's talk. And that can be scary sometimes. And I would start to discuss a variety of issues and she'd say, Mom, you told me that. And I'd say, okay, I just wanted to make sure. I don't have that good a memory to remember what we have talked about and what haven't we. But if we have talked about that, you tell me what you remember. And we could get into a discussion on that. Because I was not giving her rules, regulations, a lecture, but it got into a discussion, and she could share back with me. And I think she began to realize that that maybe the easiest way, and maybe there were some things that may have been missed or discussed, or she got a different, or there were some other questions along the way that we could begin to discuss. So to keep the lines of communication open may also depend upon what kind, how you view each other. There were times I'm sure I came on as the heavy, giving orders, warnings, threats, directions, controlling quite a bit. And then I'd do some reading or I'd do some talking or share with some other parents and realize, I've been coming on pretty heavy. Maybe I need to back off and listen a little bit more. And so listening is an important issue in dealing with teens. So we might look at some of the basics for starting this, dealing with anger in families, opening line of communication, building self-esteem in children, all coming together in a little bit. There was a book in the bookstore that's out, that's been sold out now, that's called How to Talk So Kids Will Listen, Listening So Kids Will Talk, that I think is a very basic one. When you read it, it's basically more appropriate for pre-adolescent kids, if you have those in your family as well. But the options, the suggestions in there, the experiences that it has you go through are applicable to adults to get you in tune with how it feels to be on one of these other levels of not being listened to or being talked to in a certain way. And the skills are appropriate at all ages, not just for kids, but even with partners and with friends. Parent effectiveness training is a skill, provides skills that are usable for all ages. In fact, most of the parents that I have in courses, parent effectiveness training courses, will say first, it's an 8-week session that goes 3 hours a night for 8 weeks, and about the sixth, fifth or sixth night, I'll have parents come up to me, particularly if they've had a partner in the class with them, and they'll say, it hasn't worked very well with our kids yet, but maybe that's because we're using it more on each other first. And then about the seventh session or so, they'll begin to say, we really haven't used it that much with kids first because we've been using it on each other, but the kids are beginning to use it on us because they hear us use it on each other. And after the eighth session, they'll say, it's surprising what we haven't done with our kids, but how much they've learned through this class because we've begun to use it. And that perhaps is one of the basic things, that holy show of respect, allowing the child to own the problem if it's the child's problem, the grades, child's problem. What a friend is or isn't doing. I know I wanted to protect, and I'm a rescuer by nature, I think, as perhaps most parents are. And to be able to hold my hands down or to sit back has been a difficult thing to do, even with daughters who are 22 and 25. But my daughters are fairly, our daughters are fairly open, and they'll say, Mom, aren't you supposed to be listening instead? I mean, they'll remind me sometimes, and I'll say, yeah, that's right. I guess I'll learn from you, too. But they say it respectfully, and I can accept it respectfully. And I think that's okay, because that allows them to recognize that they can share it's not a slave master relationship, but it's a human being relationship that we can share something with each other. Dealing with anger in families, I did a session at the end of last week on anger, and I think some of the basics that I might bring from that whole thing is to recognize that you own your feelings. And that's helpful as we deal with our children to whatever age, with whatever age of people that we're dealing with, that we own our own feelings. No one can make you feel, fill in the blank, without your permission. That all feelings are okay. Feelings aren't right or wrong. Feelings aren't judgeable. There aren't good feelings and bad feelings. Feelings are part of you. And to negate you don't feel that way or you shouldn't feel that way is to say, you don't know who you are. You don't know what you are. You don't know what you're feeling. I'll tell you what you're feeling. And then you listen to me and I'll make it right. And that doesn't work all the time. As a professor of mine was very fond of saying, if you've ever been worried and someone has come up to you and says, stop worrying, did you? Well, it's like telling somebody with children, as telling one of your children, oh, you really don't feel that way. You shouldn't feel that way. Don't, you know, and take the part, defend the other person because the other person isn't there and you think, I've got to protect them, I've got to support them. And the child begins to feel, nobody cares about me. No one's trying to understand me. They're all worried about that other person who isn't even part of the family. And they're protecting them without listening to me. Nobody cares, so why should I bother caring? And they tune out, and walk away. So keeping the lines of communication open and dealing with anger issues have to do a lot with tuning into those feelings, recognizing when I own the problem, and how, if I own the problem, I need to use communication skills that help me to share the problem that I own, to describe the situation that's causing the problem, to describe how I feel, and maybe what effects it has on me. You know, when I see that room in such a mess, I feel, fill in the blank. How do you feel? Disgusted. Frustrated.
Angry.
What's the feeling underneath anger? Anger is a secondary feeling that always has some other feeling. I'm afraid of what? Fear of what? Rodents are going to get in. Bugs will take over. Health department will come in and close you down. Yeah. Anger always has another feeling underneath it that's much more, that can much more identify, is much more helpful in identifying what the issue is.
I'm being dumped on.
Okay. I'm telling you to clean that room and you're not listening to me. I feel you've tuned me out and I'm not worth anything. It may not work the first time you try it, but you may, some of these skills need to be used in sequence to let them know how you feel rather than, what a pig you are, what a slob, didn't I ever teach you, how come you've ever, why don't you ever, how do you respond when somebody gives you a put down? Defensive? How else? You become defensive of yourself, you have to protect yourself. What else do you feel when somebody puts you down? Hurt, stubborn, rejected. Any others?
Afraid sometimes.
Afraid. What else can they do to me? What have I really done wrong? What should I be doing instead? Nobody loves me. A lot of feelings. So if you want to, and do you feel like changing your behavior if you've been put down, dumped on, if you feel rejected, hurt, frustrated, not loved? You don't have the energy. You spend all your energy protecting yourself, and you're not going to have much energy left to change the behavior that's wanted to that they want to have changed, or that might be ideal to have changed. Maybe even you want to have a change, but as a teen, it may be a little bit difficult at that point because there are some underlying motivations. One. Maybe that when you have power used on you, you're tempted to respond with what? Power. And you get into a power struggle. You will, I won't, you will, I won't, you will, I won't. How many have ever been in that kind of struggle? Okay. Or maybe they'll go ahead and do it sloppily, partially, and then find something to get revenge back on in some other way, that something else isn't done. Or that they'll just use inadequacy as an excuse. Dreiker's lists four basic reasons why children misbehave, and I usually rephrase that to say children of all ages. Look at your own behavior sometimes, parents. Kids look at your behavior sometimes and see what it might be that really is promoting the action that you're putting out, the behavior. I said earlier, feelings aren't judgeable. But behavior is. And you have a choice. You do have a choice on how you act on those feelings. You can do nothing. You can run away. You can fight back. And each one of those can take a variety of different forms. Put yourself down. But Dreiker says that we do things to either get attention, for power, for revenge, using inadequacy as an excuse. Teens. Three more added. That one is that there's the need for peer acceptance. Another one is feelings of superiority, that they have those need to feel superior in some way. Isn't it, the story is told about Mark Twain that when he was 16, he thought he never knew a more ignorant man than his father. And then he said when he turned 21, he was surprised at how much the old man had learned in those mere 5 years. And excitement is the third additional category for adolescents. And we might get in touch with that ourselves. How often do we do things to be accepted by other people? How often do we do things to show a sense of superiority? How often do we do things for the excitement of it all? Some of them may be very much okay. That's not to put them all down. That maybe a lot of our inventions have been a kind of use of superiority, a use of excitement or adventure, you know, need to find something new, try something new. Can also be the reason that causes a lot of problems to happen, and you need to know which will have the least negative consequences, which will have the most positive consequences. So if we're dealing with anger and trying to keep lines of communication open and feeling good about ourselves, that's a lot to put together in just a short bit of time. We might want to tune into what we're really feeling, to own our own feelings and to help our children to recognize their own feelings. And so I'll speak of this in general for both the parent level and the teen level. to be courageous and own the feeling that you have, rather than saying, you make me, it's all your fault. If only you wouldn't, then I would. And all the kinds of statements that began with you, that put the heavy load on someone else, the excuse on someone else, the blame on someone else. I wouldn't be doing this if it weren't for you, kind of response, as if I don't have any responsibility in it. And we have a good amount of responsibility. How we decide to act on those feelings, how we put those feelings into behavior, is within our range of control. Somebody can give you a put down, and you can say, well, maybe I really do need to clean up my room. Or you can say, boy, something's really bugging him or her today. I wonder what it may be. You might say, gee, Mom, Dad, I know it's a mess and it should be cleaned up, but I have a big test to study for tomorrow, or I have to leave for work in a half an hour. What if I did straighten the bed, put my clothes in the dirty clothes hamper, which might take all of 4.5 minutes, and finish the rest of it tomorrow, and then keep your word to finish it whenever you renegotiate? Because that's what builds the trust level between several people. If you want to be trusted, you need to prove yourself trustworthy. Both levels, parents and teens. To learn how to listen. When the other person's angry, when you feel angry, to maybe even be able to listen to what's to yourself, listen to what the other person is saying. And there's several ways to listen. One is just plain giving attentive silence to the other person, letting them talk if they're in the process of talking, to listen to them, nodding your head, using positive body language. Your body language, your body movements can contribute a great amount to the conversation without ever a word being said. You're standing there gripping your fist and pounding the table, even though you may not be saying anything, the other person knows that you're not listening to them. You're standing there tapping your fingers, waiting for your turn to talk. The other person knows you've not tuned in to them. But give full attention. Other might be to use what I like to call friendly grunts. The uh-huhs, mm-hmm, yeah, mm-hmm. Wow. The words that shows at least you're tuning in. They may not know whether you've understood what they're saying or not. That, if you want to help check that out, that's another step down the line. To open the door and say, looks like we really need to talk about this. Do you have time? I'm ready to listen. Whatever way you can open the door to sharing some time in the conversation. And then to use some of the skills from PET or the STEP program or whatever the program might be, a lot of different labels are used depending upon the people who have produced the program. But to check out what you hear the other person saying. Tom Gordon in PET calls it active listening. Dreiker's and the STEP and STEP Teen programs, Systematic Training for Effective Parenting, calls it reflective listening. Reflect back what you're hearing of the feelings and the content. Actively listen to what the other person is saying and then check it out in your own words, what you think you heard the other person say. So the other person can therefore either verify it or clarify it. Yes, that's what I mean, and go on. Or no, I don't mean that. What I really mean is, and give some more information to make sure that you're both on the same line. How many of you have come home at the end of come home, I won't describe the day, but you've come home and you just go, someone may, and you just sit there just looking exhausted or whatever, however you might be read, and somebody else comes and looks at you and says, uh-oh, better not cross him or her. Looks like it's been a rough day, walks away. Somebody else comes and says, you think you've had a rough day? Wait till you hear what I've had. Somebody else comes and says, Oh, don't be such a sissy. You're always feeling like you're so overworked and so overburdened. Now, so-and-so works longer hours than you do and doesn't come home looking like that and so forth. You know, how would you feel in response if you were the person who just came and sat down? How would you feel? Accepted? Heard? Understood? Probably not any of them. And maybe what really happened is something really exciting happened at work, and you've completed more than you thought. It's been an exhausting day, but it's been exhilarating, and things have fallen together, and you really feel excited, but you're also exhausted. And nobody wants to listen to you. They're putting you down without even knowing what the issue is. And you say, forget it, I'm not going to share, you know, nobody cares about me, I'm not going to share any of this with you. So, what might be helpful if the other person has some skills is to say, boy, you're looking rather exhausted. You've had a busy day, and you might say, I've had a busy day, but I am exhausted, but I'm also excited because. You can give them some further information and then share and eliminate the need for put downs, flight, escape, protection of the other, rescue of the other person. That also helps build self-esteem in that you know that you're accepted. People will listen, that you're worth being listened to, that your feelings are important, and that you're okay. And the other person's okay too. I don't have to put the other person down as I'm better than they are. They're not okay, but I'm okay. And step on them. But that we can both be okay. And so when we come to, you know, how do we deal with rudeness or hostility in teens, maybe we have to approach that from some of the basics that I've just mentioned before. Do we listen to and acknowledge feelings? Whenever they start to complain about something, do we protect the other person instead of just listening to them? Reflecting back what we hear about their feelings, checking out if we really understand what they're saying, even if it's just to the extent of, boy, that's discouraging. You must feel pretty lonely or hurt or sad or rejected or whatever. Don't be afraid of using a feeling that may give them an idea what they ought to feel. They may be feeling that, and to have your feeling recognized is part of the acceptance of you. Oh, I'm okay even with that feeling. Think of extremely rude and hostile teens, and I've certainly encountered them too, including among my own. And I have to look back at what I've just done with them. Is their hostility something that's trying to show power to me because I've shown power to them? Is it some kind of revenge because I've done something they felt was not appropriate? So we might check that out. What's the bottom line? Why are they being so hostile and rude? Most often, it may be really to get attention. Attention, power, revenge, inadequacy, etc. It may really be to use power, to beat you to the punch of using power on you rather than you using power on them. I think it's Barbara Coloroso who talks about cons. Kids will do con 1 or con 2 or con 3 on you. Con 1 is where they try to tug away at your heart. Oh, please, Mommy, do I really... you aren't going to make me. I don't have... You really want me to get good grades. I don't, you know, this trying to get out of it. Con 2 is trying to get at our head, and it says... Or is it the other? And I may be right mixed up on this. I'm getting a little bit confused. The second con is that you owe me, nobody else makes me do it. Why am I the only one? You're being unfair. how many of you have heard that kind of thing? Con three is when they turn around and say, okay, I'm not going to do it, they're using the inadequacy. I'll just sit and I'll vegetate in my room if you say they're going to be grounded or that they have to stay in or something. I don't care. I'll go up in my room. I won't ever come out. You'll never see me again. And then you start to beg, bribe, weep, wail, and gnash teeth. Say, oh, come on, give it one more try. You can do it. I know you can. And then it turns around again. But how we get, how our heartstrings get tugged at, how our head gets tugged at, or how we begin to respond in the opposite direction with them when they start to use inadequacy as an excuse. Rudeness and hostility, I often think, may go back to some very unspoken good lessons that they've had along the way. One of the last chapters in the book of How to Talk So Kids Will Listen is titled Freeing Children from Playing Roles. Whether children begin to play the role of the boss, the bully, the whiner, the know-it-all, the goody-two-shoes, what other kind of labels can we put in there? You can't make me do it. You know, a whole variety of the resistance, the stubborn, the hostile and rude. And I sometimes think we certainly don't find lesson plans to do this, but because we let certain things slide often enough and long enough, kids will recognize what they can get away with, how you respond to what they do. And if you say, you've asked them to do something, you've reminded them, you've pleaded, you've begged, you've bribed them, they don't do it, and you finally give up and say, oh, I'll do it myself, it's just so much easier, forget it. Don't ask me anything. Don't ask me for any special favors. And they know they've gotten away scot-free. I don't have to do it. They also know if they can come around and butter you up very nicely, you'll probably end up giving in. Even though you may have just said 5 minutes ago, 15 minutes ago, an hour ago, don't ask me for any more favors. If you're not going to do this for me, I'm not going to do anything for you. And then you turn around and do it anyway. So what are you teaching them? Quite by accident. I don't think it's intentional. But what are you teaching them? If you hold out long enough, someone will do it for you. That's an important lesson. Any other lessons that might be hidden underneath there?
Teaching them to lie.
Okay. Because you're going back on your own saying. You're modeling, I don't speak the truth. Don't listen to me. I really don't mean what I say. What else might you be... That they can get anything that they want in this world if they either whine long enough, beg, plead, bribe long enough. Okay. Anything else?
Just reinforcing inappropriate behavior.
Reinforcing the behavior that you want to extinguish, that you don't want to have happen, but you're rewarding them for it. And so all you're doing is encouraging it further. Yes?
Kind of topsy-turvy enough.
Yeah. A topsy-turvy order of power and control. That's not going to serve them very well when they get out in the adult status. That they can't always get away with whatever they want to with a boss. Or with a partner. Or even with some friends. But where do we go? I think we've all gotten caught in this. We don't realize when we get caught in it. I recognize even with our daughter living hundreds of miles away, that we may have a telephone call and somewhere along the line she'll start saying something and I'll say, okay, what did you use the Visa card for? And she'd say, I really saw this great sale on such and such and I didn't think you would mind and I'll pay you back. I mean, so we can recognize when we may be pulling at the next person. And and she does keep track of what she does owe. So to recognize and maybe even tune in and to discuss it with your children. You know, there's sometimes that we con each other some way or other. And maybe that's not the best lesson for me to teach you or for you to be practicing on me. And let's find another way of doing this. So I think one of the basic things that parents ought to be very versed in addition to owning your own feelings, accepting other people's feelings, being good listeners, and trying to bite the tongue not to give advice until you're invited to give advice, and to share your own feelings when you don't accept the behavior that's going on of, I really don't like it when I see, rather than you with a lot of you messages. And that's the skill of problem solving. How do our kids learn problem solving? How have you learned problem solving? I venture to say most of us learned it when we had to use it at work somewhere or other. That's where we really learned it. And if we can learn it at a much earlier stage of the game, problem solving. I think I get into problem solving in every class I teach because I just think it's so basic to recognize how can we solve problems, whether it's the curfew, whether it's the allowance, whether it's about the use of the car, whether it's about what's the status of the room, what's the minimal level of cleanliness that's acceptable to me and acceptable to you. And maybe you might work up a little bit higher than that at some other time. But where can you begin? Problem solving. We might begin where? Recognizing what the problem is. So you might identify. And in the identification, it's stating what the problem is. I'm really having a problem how we constantly go round and around about what? The room. So it's identify the basic of the problem. What are your feelings? What are the other person's feelings about it? Well, I really feel it out of, how do you feel about this? What are some of the basic needs, feelings you have? And the needs. What's the basic need level? I need to be able to have some privacy in my room, or I feel the need to put things where I know where they are and not have you come in and clean them up. And the mom may say, or dad, whoever does the laundry, and I feel the need that clothes, since clothes cost money, that they ought to be hung up if they're still clean enough, or put into the laundry if they need to be washed or taken care of and respected, to respect the things that you have. To get at the feelings and needs. That may be the biggest part of the whole, to hear the other person without putting them down. Second part, then, is to brainstorm. Brainstorm all the possibilities, all the alternatives, from the ridiculous to the sublime. Some humor in there will help relieve the tension. Sit down with a sheet of paper. Give the sheet of paper to the teen. Write them down without evaluating them. Don't say, I can't take that one. No, I wouldn't stand for that. That will cut off the flow of ideas. Take any idea, even though you bristle at it underneath. Put it down on paper that they're accepted, and that the bottom line of problem solving is that it's a win-win situation, not a win-lose. I'm going to shove a couple of things in here, and I'm going to hold out until I get my way. That's not helpful for either the teen or the parent. That's not helpful for either one in getting along with people, and we want to teach good human relations skills. So those are very important ones. The third step is to evaluate them, to look at what, evaluate the alternatives, to look at what is acceptable to you, what might not be acceptable to you. Well, I just don't like the idea of all the dishes being piled up in your room and all this food around. I'm afraid that it's going to invite little creepy crawly things and maybe running scampering things in the house. So to leave the dishes up in the room and only collect them once a week, I can't accept. Maybe there are some others. What are the consequences of each of the alternatives? And then the fourth is to choose. Choose from among those that are left. Hopefully there are some left. If not, go back and brainstorm again. Well, we need to think some more about it. Or let's, if we've run out of ideas today, let's see what we can come up with for tomorrow. Or you may go back to the ones that you've just eliminated and revise and say, well, I could accept this if. Or if we change this a little bit, maybe that would be more acceptable. How about that? You might find that a possibility. Often we're tempted to stop right there. And that will help. That will cause most plans to fail. Because what's most important is then to decide on action. Decide who's going to do what. What's going to be your responsibility, what's going to be your responsibility, and how, what's the level that you're agreeing to do this at, and when. So that you've got some contact points. You've got, the expectations are clear. How many of you own a crystal ball? Mine's not working either. But so often we assume that that the other person knows what I expect of them. Just because they've lived in this house long enough, they ought to know it. So deciding on action is an important part. There's a number of, we've got to evaluate in a second time. To choose an ending time, see how this is going to work for a week, or a day, or a month. Decide on a contact point to check how is it going. How are you accepting this? How's it working? How am I feeling? How are you feeling? And should we continue on with this? I generally say to a lot of parent groups that I do that once your children are in school age, that a lot of the rules and roles in the household, maybe even the rituals, ought to be done through a family meeting where children participate in making some decisions. What can we do as a family outing? Getting some family suggestions together. What are going to be the basic rules for when the 8-year-old goes to bed, when the 5-year-old goes to bed, when the 14-year-old goes to bed? That the 5-year-old doesn't determine what the 14-year-old does. And the 14-year-old and parents together can do some problem solving to decide, to help children learn how to think, not just what to think. Because what we really want to build up is some of that inner control that helps them recognize what they're responsible for, to look at alternatives and to choose which has the most positive consequences and the fewest negative consequences. Yes?
As you talked about bedtime.
You've got some simple responses. One is, well, we live in different households and maybe she has to do different things with her allowance than you have to do with yours. And then maybe you go back to do some problem solving and negotiating on allowances that they just don't automatically get a dollar or whatever. I think when our daughters were 8 and 11, 9 and 12, we just happened to think about it that time, not because that was a particular age, but we put them on a clothing allowance. So they had to decide what they were going to buy, and it was interesting to see how the 9-year-old began to save her money to find one of the little Izzad shirts, you know, which I think are outrageously expensive. Anyway, but that's what she was going to save for. She found it on sale at the price of the other shirts, so she and I were both doubly happy. But I think as a basis of that, she's, even when she's gone through university on a very minimal budget because we were having to translate Canadian cheap dollars into expensive U.S. ones, has done a marvelous job of managing money, managing very little money. But what is the basis of an allowance? And that may be one of the issues that you decide to problem solve with your teen or preteen. What is it going to cover? Whose responsibilities are what? And I know a number of people who say that an allowance is given only, and I firmly believe this myself, an allowance is to teach children how to handle money. It's not for doing X, Y, Z work, because you don't get paid for doing housework. We live in a home as a family to share the gifts of that family. And so for adolescent, for a pre, whatever age you give an allowance to, that's to help them learn how to spend money. And you may decide that three basic things, that's, that money has to include something for savings, something for charity, and then their own spending, whatever they have to cover with that money for their spending. If it's school supplies, if it's some part of clothes, if it's their entertainment, if it's their candy, gum, whatever, you know, how is that going to cover? And let them figure out, what is it that they're going to put for the charity? What is it that they're going to put for savings? Maybe savings for saying, whenever our kids decided they wanted a bicycle, we would say, okay, you save half of it for the bicycle and we'll come up with the other half. Or we'd balance off. Or yes, you can have it if you can pay for it. It's not high on my priority list, so I'm not going half of it. If you get some money for birthdays or whatever, you can decide where to put it toward if you'd like to, and save whatever you want to, or babysitting or paper route money, whatever. But that's for you to decide to buy. So don't be intimidated by kids who say, but so-and-so does such and such else, and I only get such and such. You may want to review and say whether it's for bedtime, whether it's the room cleanliness of the room, whether it's for how late they can stay out at night, whether it's for allowance, to say, well, people have different values. These are my values. This is how I think it's important, why I think it's important. You tell me what you think is important about this. That does a number of other things. Tells them that you're willing to listen to what they're saying, that you respect their ideas, their thoughts, their needs. It's getting involved in dialogue rather than just one-way conversations. It's telling them we can problem solve this. There's no problem so big that we can't solve it together. And if you have a question, come and talk to me about it. It shows that you're an open parent as well. And it may resolve the issue and teach them something in the process. Okay, we're going to decide on allowances. Let's look at what it should all cover and write it out and sign it. You have a copy. The child has a copy. So you're very clear on it. And the child can't say, oh, I didn't know about that. Which will happen if it's just a verbal kind of thing. How do you respond when kids come in late? Teenagers will frequently be late. How do you respond? How do you feel when they come in late?
I listen to their explanation first.
Okay. To give them respect of saying, tell me what happened. What else? What are some of your feelings when they come in late?
I think, you know, from my mother's point of view, when I used to sneak in the house at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning through the laundry room, hers was fear that I was being hurt or something.
That you didn't come in and she doesn't know where you are. So we're fearful often, but how do we generally respond?
Angry.
That's it. I can't trust you anymore. Now you're just not going to go out for the next year. And they're out 3 times the next week. So what is that telling them? Doesn't matter what I say or what I feel, you can get your way anyway. We're inconsistent. So if you want to avoid that, what can you do? Having gone through some of the skills we've just gone through before. Your daughter or son has just started to date or just started to go out more. Often when they're under the age of 15, you have to take them places and pick them back up again if they can't walk there. So you have checkpoint times. I'll meet you at 10 o'clock here. They get a little bit older and some of their peers have cars that can pick them up, and then you don't have that control any longer. So then what? How do you deal with it?
I was going to say, there's one other thing that you can do, I think, that's helpful. And that is something that doesn't involve the child directly, but in the example of coming late, what came to mind was a time when Fran was supposed to be home at a particular time, and it was later and later. I was getting anxious, and I was at the window. And to share that with your teenager.
Describe how you feel.
Yeah.
Share your words of feelings with them. Okay. What can you do before the child goes out, the teen goes out? Before the friends come to pick up the teen, preferably. Talk about your expectations. Let's figure out what's going to be the best time for you to come in. Because sometimes it might be later. Sometimes you might want it might be something you can come in early for. It's not going to last late. It closes at 10. They have a chance to get down to a Coke or whatever and get back home by 11. Why give them 1 o'clock? You know, if they have to figure out something to do to stay out that long then. There may be something else that 1 o'clock may be an appropriate time because it's a special event. And to decide, okay, this is going, because of this and this and this, maybe, is this an acceptable time? And you can agree on that. Okay, if you can't come home by that time, what?
Call.
Call by when? Before. 3 minutes after? If they can. And if they don't call, what's the consequence? One set of parents that we were talking about this with said, They asked their teen, okay, if you can't come home and you can't get to the phone and you get home late, what should be the appropriate consequence? And the teen said, well, next time I have to come in 2 times earlier than I was late. If I'm late 15 minutes, I have to be in a half an hour earlier next time. And they said, fine, fine. We were only going to say that they'd have to cut their next time by that same amount. They doubled it. So they were being harder on themselves than I was going to be. That's a logical consequence. It's a natural consequence. You don't say no television if you come in late. It doesn't relate. Or you don't get your allowance for the week if you come in late. It doesn't relate. And an allowance is not for good behavior. Allowance is to teach them how to care for money, take responsibility for themselves. One of the best ways to teach that responsibility taking. Rudeness, hostility. To share how you feel with the child. I really am bothered. I'm disappointed. I feel rejected when you respond to me with such and such words and I'm trying to talk. Or you stamp your feet or you walk out of the room. I feel that's disrespectful. How can we deal with this at a more adult level?
With my daughter, it's tone sometimes. It's not so much what is said, but how it's said.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that instead of trying to explain it to her, because she doesn't think she said it in that tone, and it gets to be kind of a power thing, that I wouldn't say anything. I wouldn't give a strange look. I just wouldn't respond. And then she'd stop and start to think, well, I met this mom or whatever. And so I might not say anything. I'm just looking, listening. She would keep trying to explain.
So she may guess from what you try to express. Another way might be to say, hey, wait a minute, I'm becoming irritated when I hear this kind of voice, or I'm tuning off. Let's start all over again. If you've just come into the room, go back out and let's come in all over again, and let's try it. Let's try it another time where we can both want to listen. And that may teach them, my using of words to them can help them recognize. We haven't gotten to the issue of sexuality. I do want to cover that. Sarah, is that tomorrow? I forget, I don't have my book with me. Wednesday evening? Okay, and the whole issue of sexuality, and especially as we deal with the issue of AIDS, the issue of birth control, pregnancy, teenage pregnancy. When the issue came up with one of the small groups and the minors this morning, the statement was, what we know at all. I said, what are some of the issues you would like to talk to your parents about sexual? Well, I know everything. And then I listened quietly. We heard it all in fifth grade. And I said, what grade are you in now? 10th grade. Aren't there some additional things that you might have thought of between fifth grade and now? Well, yeah, I guess there are. And what you heard in fifth grade, you took in with fifth grade ears for your fifth grade needs. You're 10th grade now, and those ears are different and those needs are different. And, you know, but it's awfully difficult to say, I don't know, for both parents and for teens, and we have to listen to each other to help each other that it's okay to say that and to share with each other.